And this is Focus 580, our telephone talk program. My name is David Inge. Good morning to you. Welcome back to hour number two of our show. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about the battle against malaria. And we have as our guest this morning, Robert Desowitz. He is a leading authority in the area of tropical medicine. And we'll be talking about a book that he wrote that takes a look at the battle against malaria. His book is entitled The Malaria Capers. It was published last fall by W.W. Norton. Malaria is a disease that has been with us for a long time. In fact, some very old medical texts describe the symptoms of malaria very well. And here we're talking about records that go back to a couple of thousand years B.C. The modern age for researchers of malaria came in the late 1800s when the cause was identified and also the method of the spreading of the disease by the Anopheles mosquito. By the 50s, there was a great deal of optimism that malaria could be controlled, possibly even stamped out altogether, through the use of the drugs that were available to treat malaria and also through the use of the insecticide DDT to get rid of the mosquitoes that spread the disease. However, now that optimism has faded, and in fact, as our guest writes in his book, we must remind ourselves that malaria, by sheer numbers, remains the most important disease of humans. 100 to 200 million cases every year that bring death to 1 to 2 million people. Why it is that malaria has been so difficult to stamp out is the topic of the book, The Malaria Capers, and we'll be talking this morning about that with our guest. Robert Desowitz makes his home in Honolulu, where he holds a double appointment as professor of tropical medicine and medical microbiology, and he's also a professor of public health at the University of Hawaii, and he is joining us by telephone this morning. As we talk, you folks who are listening should feel free to call in if you have questions. 333-WILL is our local number. That's 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Those are the numbers. Professor Desowitz, hello.
Good morning. Good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it. Perhaps we might just talk generally a little bit about malaria, because I think probably many of the people listening to us won't know very much about it, other than it is a disease that you associate with tropical areas, and probably there will be a lot of people who will know that it is spread by the mosquito. But maybe you could just give us a thumbnail sketch of the disease and what it's all about.
Well, actually, it's a number of diseases. The malaria consists of four malaria parasites of man, and we're also liable to the occasional infection from certain species that are carried by monkeys that can be given to man. But the four species are Plasmodium malariae, Ovale, Vivax, and falciparum. Of these, only falciparum is the true killer, although Vivax can make you feel so terrible that indeed you feel that you're in mortal danger. All of them are carried by various species of the Anopheles mosquito, and they have a sexual development in the mosquito that takes about 14 to 20 days, depending upon temperature and the species. It's a very complex cycle within the mosquitoes. The other, as the mosquito bites human, the parasite enters the blood and very quickly goes to the liver, where it may remain for several weeks, and it's a quiescent period. In Vivax and Ovale malaria, some of these stages remain dormant. The word was called hypnozoites, the sleeping stages. And they can reactivate, come back to life to cause new infections up to 5 years later. Falciparum malaria invades in a prodigious fashion, and if it's left checked in humans, in immunologically virgin humans, such as travelers, children, and my particular interest, pregnant ladies, then it can overwhelm the host in different ways, affecting different organs, but most notably the brain. It causes deep coma and cerebral malaria and death. Mm-hmm. That's the 50-minute lecture on the life cycle without slides within several minutes. All parasitologists have a compulsion to go through life cycles in a very detailed fashion.
Well, you know, I think it's important to understand at least a little bit about the complexity of the life cycle of the organism or organisms that cause malaria, because one of the stories that you tell in the book is the effort to develop a vaccine, which has not proven successful, perhaps for a number of reasons that we can go into. But I suppose the one thing that has frustrated researchers is the fact that it is a very complex, the life cycle of this organism is very complex. And if you were going to develop a vaccine, you couldn't just have one. You would have to have a different vaccine for every stage in the life cycle, and would somehow have to be able to give them all to an individual to really make sure that you were going to provide them with immunity. At least now that's my understanding.
Well, that's some of it. Of course, it's even more complex than that. Each stage of the life cycle, and we could go through, you know, from the sporozoite to the exerythrocytic stage, through the schizon, through the gametocyte, to name the words as they go through this successively. The bacteriologists and the virologists have it relatively simple. A bacteria is a bacteria is a bacteria. A virus is a virus is a virus. But as I said, a malaria parasite goes through all of these successive stages, and each stage is profoundly different in its antigenic constitution. And we don't know within this very complex constitution which parts of which segments, which proteins, which antigens actually may be antigenic, which may induce a protective immunity. To complicate this even further, malaria has, within even its species, has an enormous diversity. You know, we know this in flu, of course, this antigenic shift, antigenic change. And malaria, from locale to locale, can be very, very different. A person who grows up in one village and is protected develops in a very expensive way to his own personal health, finally develops an immunity. If he goes to a village maybe 20 miles away, much of that immunity is lost. It's not quite as dire as the African trypanosome, which changes its antigenic code every 3 days, but it's bad enough to make it a very frustrating attempt for researchers to develop this vaccine. Mm. However, they may have focused in the wrong way, because I believe that the object of the game is interruption of transmission, and if we try to make a vaccine that against the transmissive elements, possibly we might be more successful.
The story of the effort to develop a vaccine has some elements of its scientific misconduct, to be kind, and perhaps fraud is really the word one ought to use. Can you tell some of that story?
I must say that there are large numbers of dedicated, completely ethical scientists all over the world, including the United States, who have been and are continuously engaged in a search for a vaccine. The difficulty, I think, arose some 25 years ago when all the money that AID, American our development, international development agency, had I think it was $1 billion that they put in over about 10, 15 years into the grand scheme of eradicating malaria. When that failed, they were looking to cover their derrieres in some credible technical fashion. And they were sold on the idea that a vaccine might be possible by my name is Silverman, Paul Silverman, who was an old friend of mine and worked on mostly on helminths, and he felt that indeed it was possible to immunize against malaria. And all the scientists told AID, look, you've never been in the research business. You don't know how to conduct it. The idea of a malaria vaccine should be pursued, but it's kind of flaky. Don't get high hopes into it. What AID then did was to pour almost their entire resources, started a whole research program without benefit of professionals, against the advice of professionals, without benefit of leadership by professionals, and they went ahead. And they got partial immunization with a rather, what we would consider a dirty vaccine, by today's standards, in rhesus monkeys with a monkey malaria. Well, what they had to do even to get that was use a kind of chemical booster, which was so savage that it could never be used in a human. It would cause encephalitis, it would cause great lesions. This was called Freund's adjuvant. Well, in the end, that was dropped, but the program wasn't dropped. At this time, biotechnology and all its attractions entered the picture. And they said, people said, we could make a vaccine. And indeed, from New York University, they came in with the sporozoite vaccine, which in turn, entirely synthetic, came out of the shelf. And it protected mice, protected about 1 out of 9 human beings. And that one human or several humans developed an allergic reaction, but the press, and everybody went to the press and said, the vaccine is around the corner. At this time, they got another leader, the first manager from AID, left. He was an entomologist, not an immunologist. They got another entomologist, who I think his background, James Erickson, was a agricultural entomologist, and he ran this thing like the Gauleiter, the vaccine Gauleiter. Unfortunately, he was also turned out to be rather crooked. He established his own dummy companies for buying monkeys from South America, which they claimed had to be used as the model. And in the end, he was indicted, pled guilty, and was sentenced, I think, to 6 months or something like this. This was the leader of the whole scheme. Meanwhile, what he was doing, the original charge was a sexual harassment charge. What he was also doing, they made him chief of everything, including his own, he became his own superior, and he had a favored few people who was researchers, network of researchers, who, when the reviewers came in, said, look, this is bad research, he would say it's wonderful research, and he funded them also. At least two of those reviewers were accused of taking money. Ristic from Illinois, I'm afraid to say. He's Illinois, who was a veterinarian, and has either been convicted or pled guilty. And Wasim Siddiqui, I'm sorry to say, who was from Hawaii, who ran a large program, and he, after 2.5 years, is still awaiting trial, supposed to go to trial in August, for stealing something like $135,000, $150,000, I can't remember the exact sum, in various fiscal manipulations, but that's still under the the subjudice, I suppose, that it is, and that trial and its revelations will come out shortly. Meanwhile, this goes on with AID. They still maintain the program, and nothing has come out of this except that possibly a lot of mischief in some ways, because they keep going to, or they had kept going to the press, making announcements that the vaccine is around the corner. Beleaguered government said, you know, let's give it up. Why are we spending all this money to spray and give drugs? You know, the vaccine is around the corner. Mm. And gave up on it. Went out and bought a new Mercedes. It's an intriguing story when you actually look at how the fiscal manipulations and the dummy companies went up. Nothing like this has ever happened in science before. And certainly nothing has ever happened like this in malariology, where there have been sort of bitter arguments between people and clashes, but never tainted in any this way. It's rather sad.
Well, and what's particularly, I think, sad, just to underscore the point you made, is that one of the results was that, as you say, people said, well, any day now we're going to have a vaccine, which meant that money that had been going into efforts to spray, to get rid of the mosquitoes and to make sure that there's at least treatment for people using the drugs we have available, that kind of treatment was abandoned. People said, well, we don't need to do this anymore because next week we're going to have a vaccine. And so the vaccine never comes. We stopped doing the things we could do. And apparently that has really resulted in an increase in the number of people who have the disease.
And we lost balance in our research as well. It was all in the basket, you know, all those eggs, all those mm-hmm. golden eggs have gone mostly in one basket. And some of the more practical or other approaches, balanced approaches, were abandoned. You know, there's very little money for third world research, and we've been seduced by completely seduced. I don't mind being partially seduced. You know, like the curate's egg, I suppose. By high technology, that research must always go on, but it must be balanced by attending to the kind of development for actual needs of people living in villages. And I know when I even suggested this in my book, and I never called for abandonment of all this work, Max Perutz from Cambridge, who was a Nobel laureate and kind of the high panjandrum of high technology, ended up, I think he liked the book, but ended up, which he thought I was attacking the whole research establishment, said, you know, this is corrupt, which of course I don't think it was. The book excited a certain amount of controversy in the community, which I think was its intention as well.
Well, we have some people to talk with, and let me reintroduce our guest for this part of the morning. We're talking with Robert Desowitz. He is a leading researcher of tropical diseases and has been doing that work for several decades now. He is currently a professor of tropical medicine and public health at University of Hawaii, and is author of a book you might want to take a look at if this subject interests you. The book is entitled The Malaria Capers, and it was published last fall by W.W. Norton, so you should be able to find it. It is about the effort to understand and treat malaria. Here we have several people lined up with questions, so let's do that. We'll start with our toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. I have a basic...
We can all hear you. From Honolulu.
Okay. I have a basic question. For some years now, in fact, we live just about 40 miles from the station where you're talking, and for some years we have had reports on encephalitis, and when they give out the information, we try to do what they tell us we should do. We burn citronella during the evening. We're outdoor people. We prefer the outdoors in the summertime because we're sort of cooped up in the winter. But we like to work in our yard, and we like to be in our yard, and we've done everything we could, I hope, to cut down on water. We keep our rain barrel lids firmly on, except when they're in use, and we try to drain off our runoff as best we can. And I've more or less followed all the rules. How serious is this, and do we really need to worry about it in this particular area? If so, do we need to take extra precautions?
Well, this is a little part for malaria. It's mosquito-borne, but I think in your area it's a Culex-borne mosquito and breeds in, I think, large water stands, I say. I'm not a virologist, and I don't know too much about your particular situation. I think you're doing everything you can.
Well, I know the last few years with this terrible heat that has come on, the mosquitoes are as big as flies, and the flies are even...
Well, that's... Yeah, I think we're getting a greenhouse effect, possibly, and things are indeed changing. My wife and I were in the highlands of Irianjaya, New Guinea, and they were having malaria outbreaks there, which they never had before, and they ascribed that to the higher temperatures and new breeding. So things indeed may be a-changing as far as the mosquito goes. You're doing everything you can. What's right? You're covering yourself up. I would suggest you, when you're outside in the peak biting hours, probably which is around dusk, and you might ask your local entomologist what the behavior of that particular vector is, because you got to remember, each vector is genetically sort of controlled by in its tiny mind or a few cells that it calls its brain. Into a very selective type of behavior, who it bites, when it flies, when it doesn't fly, where it lays its eggs, etc. And you might call them up and say, what's your biting time? What's your peak biting time? When are we at risk?
Well, I think our entomologist is what, Faye Berendom? Or is it May?
May.
May, yeah. And she's the one that has put out such wonderful information on the ones we need to watch out for, especially these sleeping sickness types. And I don't recall her mentioning a malaria type of mosquito in this area, but since things are changing, and I think a lot of people are beginning to realize how severe of a change we've had in the last 10 years. And I think none of us really know exactly.
Well, the changes would be for all mosquitoes, not only the malaria mosquitoes, which indeed exist. A kind of potential vectors did exist. Malaria was the great American disease until the 40s, actually. I think it went right up into southern Ohio and Illinois.
Oh, my goodness.
But that's all gone now.
Oh.
But for your own personal safety, for encephalitis, for the viral encephalitis, which I think is Culex-borne in your area. If you were out and at risk and exposed, possibly go on to some of the repellents, which last 45, 60 minutes, something like that.
Well, we have used off on our skin, and I buy the big buckets of citronella, and we burn those.
Well,
and at dusk.
I think you're safe.
You think we're safe?
You sound safe.
Thank you very much.
Okay, well, I thank you for the call. Let's go on here. We'll talk with the caller next, line number two. Hello.
Hello, yes. I have a question concerning the safety of the immunization procedure for young children. I'm planning a trip to West Africa in December with two young children, one of whom will be under 1 year. And I was just concerned about the safety of the treatment that... you have to undergo before going to a West African country to prevent malaria.
There you want to speak to your physician for your general immunizations. Mm. They'll need yellow fever, which I think is all right, and certainly keep up the tetanus and polio and all the other shots. There are certain physicians, infectious disease physicians, medicine clinic on that. I wouldn't want to describe. Your real problem will be in a very young child preventing malaria in a area that is now drug resistant to most drugs. And in the old days, you know, again, my children were raised in West Africa and I lived there as well. They're perfectly healthy. But we were able to give them their early chloroquine, but that is all denied us now. And you will, depending where you, well, virtually all of West Africa, even in the cities now, have become malarious. So, and children, are extremely vulnerable. It's the children who become comatose and die and fall apart very quickly with falciparum malaria, which is the major species in West Africa. Vivax does not exist there even. So you got to be careful. I think you would have to make sure your child, first of all, sleeps under a good mosquito net and possibly spray the net with a knockdown spray before sleeping. Make sure the child is well tucked in. As a prophylactic, again, you should consult your either the CDC or a travel medicine clinic. And the experience so far has been good using mefloquine, or it goes by trade name Larium, as a prophylactic during. How long are you going to be there?
Probably a month.
Mm-hmm.
My husband is African, and I'm white. So I was concerned about that because one of our children is heterozygous for sickle cell, which I've heard sometimes or may give an immunity to malaria, but that's probably not something I should count on.
No, they get malaria. Sickle cell, the heterozygotes, get malaria, but they don't die of it, or they can, but they usually don't. Mm-hmm. It slows the growth of the parasite, but is not entirely protective, and particularly very young children can suffer. So I would keep the child under if necessary, even bring a mosquito net with you. I'm sure you could buy one there, and good knockdown spray, and possibly go to a prophylactic cover of Larium on the advice of a good travel clinic, and that's what I do. And be careful.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go on to talk with somebody else. We'll go to line number one. Hello.
Yes, sir. There is an excellent, valid, definite remedy for this in a book by a Canadian. It's only 64 pages, and not to tell you the phone number or the address.
Sure, if you want.
Okay. First, the phone number. It don't cost a lot to call there. It's 1-403-662-3077.
Mm-hmm.
And the address is Global Health Limited, Box 10. Wait a minute. Box 18, comma, site 1, comma, row route 2. The cities are two in Canada. They're listed one after the other. The first city is Tofield, T-O-F-I-E-L-D, comma, Alberta, comma. Canada.
Uh-huh.
The zip is not numbers as in America. It's T-O-B space.
Okay.
4-J-O.
Okay.
And I did tell, would you please repeat the phone number?
Okay, 403-662-3077. 3077.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Well, if that's something people want to investigate, they can do that. Just to talk for a moment about treatment, for a long time, there was only one drug for treating malaria, and that was quinine, and had been in use, had been known for quite a long time. It's something that's derived from the bark of a tree that grows in South America. It worked pretty well, although there were some side effects, and I think probably people were glad when I think it was in the 1930s there started to be synthetic drugs. Chloroquine, one that you mentioned, was one of them, and I think probably still is fairly widely used. Although I gather that there has not really been very much research aimed at trying to find better anti-malarial drugs. Why is that? Why don't we have better drugs?
Well, it's research on drugs in some ways is very empirical and very expensive. One tries to make a logical drug, but we don't know that much about the biochemistry, really, of the parasite. And so one makes thousands of formulations. During World War II, when malaria was an extremely important problem, the United States Commission, looking for new drug, screened rather empirically something like 200,000 compounds, something of that sort, enormous number. Today, because of that great expense, and in some ways a rather shot-in-the-dark approach to this as well, drug companies just aren't interested in drugs for poor people. And the people who are affected by malaria, the great numbers where you could sell large amounts of drugs, are poor. They can't pay a dollar a pill. That's the per capita. So, cost for health for the whole year is probably a dollar. So modern drug companies, no longer stirred by colonial governments and their needs to keep the locals healthy and the administrators healthy, have virtually stopped all research on drugs for tropical diseases. There are a few new ones or a few old ones that are coming to the fore, but even these are not being licensed or not undergoing this long, tedious, expensive process of being licensed in the United States. And many of the tropical countries wrongly feel, well, if it's not good enough to be licensed in the United States, it's not good enough for us either. In a rather confused way. So that's essentially what's happened. The interest in drugs has gone. You can't sell stockholders the idea that we're putting millions into research with little to gain. Sometimes I can't blame that.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with some other people who are listening here. Line 3 would be our next caller. Hello.
Good morning. I wanted to ask about public health plans, but what you were just talking about raises to mind the idea that of the overuse of common drugs in the tropics, and I guess the pharmaceuticals are quite happy to sell those. And isn't that really why a lot of the efficacy is lost? Is because some of these treatments have been used, you know.
This is what it's abuse is the attribute. I'm not completely sure of this. This is the way you give underdosing is the way you produce drug resistance in animals, in the animal models, and it probably is indeed true. It may be a simple selection process, and over a period, no drug, even how carefully it's being used, is eventually going to be free of resistant strains. I really don't know, and I don't think good enough research has been done on this.
Mm-hmm.
Nevertheless, indeed, what had happened after the malaria campaign failed, WHO and World Health Organization in particular said, now we must go to a different scheme of things. We must go into primary health care. And where this is working, which it is in many parts of the tropical world, you find small aid posts with maybe 10 drugs in virtually every village with an aid post or a health orderly. So anybody comes with a fever gets 2 chloroquine, 2 aspirin, and is sent home. And it works in some ways. It saves people, even with marginally drug-resistant strains. They never get well. They actually, well, you never do. But it does indeed save people. It makes them a rather sick crowd. But it does work that way. So there is indeed a great deal of drug abuse, but it does have its good side as well in the village setting.
Can you comment on the strategy of the former Nicaraguan government and their public health plan, where they actually just gave anti-malarials out all at the same time and waited long enough that it was the period of the life of the mosquito had elapsed by twice or something like that, so that there were no vectors? It seems to actually have eradicated the parasite as a vector, so that to this day they have less malaria, despite the fact that they're not doing as much in that regard.
Well, the vectors are always going to be there. The idea is transmission, and if you got a kind of sterile population, it's okay to have mosquitoes. There's nothing wrong with that as long as they're not carrying anything. And I dare say, if we looked around, we probably have as many potentially dangerous anopheline vectors in the United States as we had during pre-TVA days, when malaria was the chief cause of American morbidity in many parts of our country. So what I think they try to do is give very special drugs in a mass way to kill off the sexual stages in the blood. And these need, as I say, very special drugs, and kind of sterilize the population and reduce transmission or interrupt transmission. It was a good idea, and possibly the Nicaraguan government and dictatorial governments can do that. But where you try to impose mass inoculation, mass chemotherapy upon a population, the compliance is very, very is low, is very, very difficult. People like passive one-shot things. They don't want to clean up the swamp. They don't want to take drugs all the time. And as I understand it, much of that malaria is now coming back to Nicaragua again, because they didn't clean up everything. But they got a bit of respite.
They used a lot of persuasion with their healthcare workers, but that's a digression. I wanted to check one thing, if I could, about maybe an apocryphal story about Silverman when he was here in the, I guess it's as far back as the late 60s. He was very sure that he had the malarial vaccine, if he just could do the research, and supposedly had a conversation with Indira Gandhi and said, I'll continue my research if you introduce a family planning program. And she couldn't do it, and he said, well, I'll do some other research. I got this from a research assistant from him, so it's probably apocryphal, but it brings up the whole issue of family planning in the tropics and that sort of thing. Have you ever heard anything like that?
Yes, and I've been trying to trace it down. I called Lawrence Altman when I was writing the book about something like this in Lawrence Altman from New York Times, the medical writer there, because I had somewhere stuck in the back of my mind that there was a New York Times article back in the very early 70s or late 60s in which AID said we would not undertake a malaria sanitation. In these countries, malaria very often, directly or indirectly, will kill 40% of the children. And the very slow development of immunity allows people to develop a functional kind of immunity when they reach working age. It's not sterile, but it is functional. They don't come down with clinical attacks. So what malaria had done in a in potentially burgeoning population, malaria was the great control, birth control program. It killed babies. So what Paul had said, and what the great fear had always been, even today, King in the Lancet said, because this is the new BedNet program, which seems to be working, in pregnant BedNet, he said, we got to be very careful because, again, we're going to have a population explosion. Paul Silverman, who was is an old and dear friend of mine, we both did our doctorates at the same time, he in Liverpool, I in London, when I interviewed him about, never told me about that story. He told me he thought he had a vaccine that was ready to be tested in Brazil, and at the time the oil embargo came on and they stopped all the research. That vaccine would now never be used in humans. It would be considered too dirty. It was impure. It had some red cell material in it. I'm not quite in agreement with that, but that's the way of the world now in the vaccine testing business. So we'll never know, but I certainly will ask him about it next time.
Thank you.
Okay, let's go on. Another caller here on the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, good morning. During World War II, I was stationed in Ley, New Guinea, and the Japanese had cut off the quinine, so the Army had atabrine tablets. Are you familiar with those?
Oh, very much so.
We all took them, and
yellow.
Eyeballs
solidarity
yellow.
The third world, yes.
And
yes.
Skin had turned yellow, but it prevented people from getting malaria. And why did they quit using that over there in the countries that they have a lot of malaria?
Well, atabrine had problems. It turned yellow, it turned your eyes. It was cosmetically acceptable. It had certain side effects, one of which occasionally drove people psychotic, which was not exactly a mild side effect.
Well, I never knew of any of them in our outfit that ever got it, and I was there for over 2 years.
It was very rare, but it did happen. But about that same time, chloroquine, which was much more active, was introduced and superseded, rightly so, atabrine. And then when strains became resistant to chloroquine, they found that they were also cross-resistant to the atabrine as well. So atabrine was never, we never took atabrine up again as an anti-malarial.
Now, quinine over a period of time will cause a ringing of the ears, I understand. Is that true?
Oh, that is indeed true. That is indeed true. I have a slight buzz myself from taking quinine some years back.
Do you know what people use it for in this country? When you're going to take an examination, you use that to prevent examination jitters. Are you aware of that?
It affects, it burns off some sugar. This is one of the problems in giving it to people with very high malarias who are acutely ill. It has a...
and political?
Well, it's economic in the fact that when people get rich and screen the houses, we did in the United States, there virtually will be no more malaria. Yes, it is. Rich people don't have malaria unless they go to poor countries. But that day where people will, in villages, will build anti-malarial houses is a long way off.
But we had literature from Shell Oil Company, and in that literature said that a mosquito doesn't fly over 200 feet unless it is driven by the wind. And we used to spray all around our company area a mixture of kerosene and motor oil after every rain, and we controlled the mosquitoes so that we didn't even have mosquitoes.
Well, that's a whole other program. But the fact is, each mosquito is very, very different in the way it will breed and the way it will fly. Some are very strong flyers, and with the wind can be carried a relatively long way.
Yeah.
Other mosquitoes will breed in very small collections of water. Other mosquitoes.
Oh yeah, even over an animal, the steps you have a little puddle of water. But if you want to control mosquitoes here in your yard, and you have, say, a rain barrel or anything that holds water, all you do is just drop about half a teaspoon of vegetable oil in it.
Oh, that's great. That's the old-fashioned and very effective way for controlling rain barrel breeding and even pond breeding mosquitoes. They use light diesel oil. It works very, very well.
Well, you can use vegetable oil, which is biodegradable.
That's right.
Thank you.
Okay. We're coming down here to the point we only have about a minute. There is one thing that I wanted to have you talk a little bit about. Perhaps we haven't got enough time, but that is that why it is that the spraying efforts that were undertaken by World Health Organization, say, in the late 50s and into the 60s, didn't really do what they hoped that they would do. The effort to go in there and to use, I guess the chemical they used mostly was DDT, to spray to kill
chemical.
The mosquitoes.
Wonderful chemical. Nothing like it has ever been developed again. In fact, it was so wonderful, it was too good, and the agricultural people took it up, used it indiscriminately, and the mosquitoes very quickly became resistant, both physiologically and behaviorally resistant. And then, of course, the people who developed this program didn't realize of the great diversity of mosquito behavior, and there were some mosquitoes which bit outdoors, which were not affected by the kind of household spraying program that was formulated, was the whole basis of the strategy for that for the global eradication scheme. So it was bad biology in some ways, or faulty biology as well, mixed with intemperate use by, I think, agriculturists.
Well, we will have to stop at this point because we're at the end of the time. I will recommend to people, if they'd like to read more on the topic, they can take a look at the book. It's entitled The Malaria Capers, and it's published by Norton, by W.W. Norton, and it's by Robert Desowitz, and the book was published last fall. Well, Professor Desowitz, thank you very much for talking with us.
My great pleasure. Thank you.